Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello. Let's do it again. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with a program that helps you learn and improve your American English. At the same time, we give you important details about things happening in our world as it is. On today's program, Kenya looks to the future in hopes of solving energy needs. But one proposal is causing problems. We'll tell you why. Then we will hear from the United Nations concerning the need for food aid in Mali. It is a bigger problem than they had expected. VOA is on the air and is coming to you from Washington. Kenya is moving forward with plans to build a nuclear power plant by 2025 as part of a larger development program. But as in other countries, Kenya has activists who do not believe nuclear power is safe compared to other kinds of energy. Christopher Cruz joins us.
At the University of Nairobi, some students are training for the jobs of the future at what is expected to be Kenya's first nuclear power center. The Institute of Nuclear Science and Technology trains 15 students a year to be technicians and engineers. The students will earn a master's degree at the end of their study program. David Maina is the director of the institute. He says producing more electricity is important to Kenya's development.
The kind of things this country is imagining that they want to do require a lot of power. Here we are with only 1,600 megawatts. What can we do? If you compare that to a country like Korea, which has 43,000 megawatts, you see we are a tiny consumer compared to those big economies.
About 69% of Kenyans live in homes without electricity. One nuclear reactor could produce up to 1,000 megawatts of power for those homes. At a recent meeting in Nairobi, supporters of the nuclear project talked about whether it could happen. The project would require a major investment of public money and increased security. William Ruto is Kenya's deputy president. He believes nuclear power can change his country for the better.
Kenya's stated intention of using nuclear energy for electricity generation reflects the sort of thinking which can propel a country from relative mediocrity to the realms of greatness.
Some developed nations have turned away from nuclear power after the disaster at Japan's Fukushima plant in 2011. Germany plans to close all of its nuclear plants by 2022. Some activists in Kenya fear a nuclear plant could increase the possibility of a Fukushima-like disaster, and they are worried that it could become a target for terrorists. On the hills near Nairobi, workers are building another power project. When it is finished, the Ngong Hills wind farm will provide about 50 megawatts of power. That is much less than a nuclear plant could generate. Moses Ole Kinaya works at the Maasai Integrated Development Initiative. He would like to see Kenya build more wind farms.
Renewable energy, I think, is more safe. Because, for example, as you see the turbines here, they have been planted, they're producing power. It's not, doesn't have any major health risks. Doesn't have any major even security risks because they just have a guard. Nobody is necessarily targeting it in terms of creating mass destruction.
Kenya is also developing projects using coal and geothermal energy, which makes energy from heat deep in the ground. While nuclear power may be the most productive source, it is also the most costly. The cost for a single nuclear power station is more than $4 billion. I'm Christopher Cruz.
The United Nations says the humanitarian crisis in Mali is getting worse. The agency says by June, hundreds of thousands more people may have trouble getting enough food. It says the money being provided for humanitarian assistance in the West African nation is much less than is needed. And it says the problem is getting worse because people who fled the conflict in the country in 2012 and 2013 are now returning. The United Nations says 1.4 million people in Mali now need food aid. That is an increase from 812,000 last December. The agency fears the number could increase to 1.9 million by June. Late and unreliable rains last year added to the conflict in the north, meaning farmers throughout the country could not grow many crops. David Gressley is the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Mali.
Mali continues to face very important humanitarian challenges in 2014. People have just gone through a very, very difficult period in Mali, and particularly in the north, with the conflict, with the occupation. People are even more vulnerable than normal because of all of this. We're seeing in particular on the food side continued food insecurity, so we're quite concerned.
Mr. Gressley says about 500,000 children under the age of 5 in Mali will suffer from moderate to severe malnutrition this year. He says 136,000 children will suffer severe malnourishment. He says there could be an increase in child deaths in Mali if they do not get enough food. He says aid workers are also worried that the food problem will worsen as people displaced by the conflict return, including internally displaced persons called IDPs.
We're seeing increasing numbers of refugees coming home. Half the IDPs have come home. Puts an additional burden on local communities as the numbers increase. It will take a while before those who are coming home can also contribute to local production. The agriculture campaign is just now starting, so they can start, but that we won't see any output from that until at the end of the year.
Mr. Gressley said the number of people returning to the country could increase quickly in the next few months, especially if there is progress in peace talks. The UN says it needs $568 million for aid efforts in Mali, including food aid in 2014. By the end of last month, donors had given only about 10% of that. Mr. Gressley is worried.
It's unfortunate, but there are many crises around the world right now in South Sudan, Central African Republic, Syria, etc., that seem to be drawing the resources that are really needed also in places like Mali. And the problem I see with that, not only the humanitarian impact, if you look at the overall needs of Mali in terms of trying to stabilize after the conflict of 2012, insufficient humanitarian assistance is actually a destabilizing impact. It has a destabilizing impact as well.
Mr. Gressley says the UN is trying to persuade more countries and organizations to help the people of Mali by showing them there is still a great need. We have just enough time to give you some Americana, what is happening in the United States. Today, more than 3.5 million people will be in Texas for the Festival of San Antonio. They will enjoy parades, sports, fireworks, dances, artwork, and just have fun. The festival also remembers those who fought at the Alamo for Texas independence in 1836. Thank you for spending some time with us today. There is world news at the beginning of the hour. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. During 3 months in 1994, 800,000 Rwandans were killed in attacks led by ethnic Hutu militias. Most of the victims were ethnic Tutsis. Many organizations around the world are observing the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. One of these groups is the Shoah Foundation Student Association at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. It invited survivors to share their memories of the horrific event. Yannick Tana has been traveling the world to talk about the genocide. He spoke about his experiences to a crowd of students at USC. He told them what happened in his country and what happened to his own family.
I remember the first time I saw the killing, first time I saw people being killed, the first time I saw bodies.
He was only 4 years old at the time. He said he hid in bushes and heard screams. He said he saw big bloody knives and bodies on the street everywhere. Mr. Tana's one-year-old brother and his grandmother were killed. Rwandan Edith Umugiraneza said she struggled with the guilt she felt for surviving when her mother, brothers, and other relatives did not.
Because I was blaming, why did I survive? Why I didn't go with others? Why? I had the question, why all the time.
Ms. Umugiraneza now lives in the United States. She said prayer and sharing stories with other survivors has helped her heal.
It happened and we can't bring back our people. So we have to move on and we have to help each other.
Her story is part of the video records at the Foundation's Institute for Visual History and Education. The Institute has been collecting stories of genocide survivors from several countries. It hopes to gather 500 stories for Rwanda. It has collected 65 so far. The Institute is also involved with Kwibuka 20, a series of events to observe the 20th anniversary. Stephen Smith leads the group.
People all around the world are coming together as a world community to reflect on what happened, but also to leave their voice and to make it their point of view very clear about genocide in the world today, what we can do about that, how we can be involved.
University student Gregory Irwin says he has wanted to do something about genocide ever since he visited Rwanda. He met survivors there and heard their stories.
I've been more driven to do something about genocide than ever.
Student Nora Snyder also visited Rwanda.
Things like what happened in Rwanda are still going on in the world today, and things will continue to happen unless we take the time to remember.
And that's the Education Report from VOA Learning English. For more stories and video reports about education and other subjects, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. You can send us comments on this story. Our email address is learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Jerry Watson. ¶¶
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, a weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the Amistad case. The Amistad was a slave ship from Cuba. In 1839, it appeared off the eastern coast of the United States. The Africans on the ship had killed white crew members, including the captain. They demanded to go back home to Africa. But the two remaining slave traders on the ship secretly sailed the Amistad toward the United States. The U.S. government put the Africans in a low-security prison in New Haven, Connecticut, and it made plans to take the Africans to court. A judge would decide whether the occupants of the ship were slaves who had rebelled, murderers, or captives who had been kidnapped from their homes. The Amistad case brought attention once again to the issue of slavery in the United States. At the time, slavery was legal and an important part of the country's economy. But the U.S. and several European countries had banned the international slave trade. A small group of activists wanted to totally end slavery. They believed slavery was a sin. But in the 1830s, most Americans did not support these anti-slavery activists known as abolitionists.
Most Americans, first of all, were racist, and secondly, saw these people as utter fanatics who were intent on destroying the Union.
Julie Roy Jeffrey is a professor of history at Goucher College in Maryland. She says newspapers reported on the Amistad case, and people began talking about slavery and the slave trade. Slowly, some Americans' feelings toward the abolitionist movement and enslaved Africans changed.
For example, there was a play put on in New York City called The Black Schooner that was based on the Amistad incident. And there were many, many people who went to see it. It became a popular event. And wax figures of the captives were exhibited in various places in the United States, and artists drew pictures of them.
The abolitionists wanted to make more Americans sympathetic to the Amistad Africans. They found lawyers to represent them, paid tutors to teach them, and organized outdoor exercises to keep them healthy and visible. Howard Jones taught history at the University of Virginia. He says one of the most popular members of the Amistad Africans was an 8-year-old boy who had learned English. The boy told the public about his life in Africa and about the conditions on the slave ship that brought him across the Atlantic Ocean. The Amistad case also was increasingly becoming a political issue. People wanted to know what President Martin Van Buren was going to do about the case. Historian Howard Jones says Van Buren found the position difficult. He did not want to anger Southern voters who supported slavery and wanted to make the African slave trade legal again. He also did not want to anger Northern voters who believed the Amistad Africans had been mistreated.
Van Buren did what any good politician would do, and that was to try to dodge the issue, stay away from it. He couldn't understand why 40-plus, by this time, black people should affect anything happening in high political society.
But the Amistad issue would not go away. The case began in a circuit court. After 3 days, it went to a district court. The district court judge ruled that the African slave trade was illegal under international treaties. For that reason, the Africans were wrongly taken. President Van Buren was worried the decision would cause more political problems for him, so he ordered the nation's highest court, the Supreme Court, to hear the case. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at that time was Joseph Story. Story did not like slavery, but he did not support the abolitionist movement either. He thought its ideas opposed the rule of law. The abolitionists had good lawyers, but they knew they needed more help arguing their case in the Supreme Court. So they turned to former President John Quincy Adams. At the time, Adams was a congressman, not an abolitionist. But he led a campaign against an 1836 rule restricting anti-slavery petitions. Adams said the rule was a violation of the constitutional right to petition Congress. Historian Julie Jeffrey says the 1836 gag rule, as it was called, helped the abolitionists' cause.
It became partly a freedom of speech issue, not just about slavery, but about the rights of citizens to speak out and to be heard by their representatives in Congress.
Yet John Quincy Adams was not excited about arguing the Amistad case. He was 72 years old, nearly blind, and very busy. But the issue of the Amistad Africans troubled him. Howard Jones says Adams believed capturing people and enslaving them was immoral, especially in a country like the United States. In the end, Adams agreed to defend the Africans.
And he makes the argument in the court case that we have the Declaration of Independence right there on that wall, and that says that life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, it doesn't say for white people only or anything like that. He was trying to argue that it's something that's available for everyone. It's part of the justice system.
Chief Justice Joseph Story did not totally accept Adams' argument or suggest that any kind of slavery was wrong, but he did agree with the district court that these Africans had been taken illegally from their homes. They were not and had never been slaves, Justice Story said. They were free people and should be returned home. So in 1841, the remaining 30 or so members of the Amistad captives got on a ship called the Gentleman and returned to West Africa. Howard Jones says the incident was the only time he knows that black people who had been brought to the New World as slaves actually made it back home.
And how they do it? By winning in the American court system. This was just unheard of. But the decision was basically that it doesn't matter whether you are black, white, purple, green, or whatever color you are, you have been kidnapped. And so therefore you have, and Joseph Story said this in his decision, which really opened the door for a lot of arguments, that under the eternal principles of justice, you have the inherent right of self-defense, even if you must kill your captors.
Howard Jones says the Supreme Court decision also gave the abolitionists a new sense of power.
And the abolitionists immediately printed pamphlets, leaflets, had talks, everything they could to show that these people went free, and their implication was this is what's going to happen to slavery itself, that this is a great victory for the black man.
But the Amistad case did not really change the situation in the United States for most black people. Many were the children of slaves and could not argue that they had been kidnapped from Africa. And it was still legal to trade slaves across U.S. state borders. The Amistad case also did not solve all the problems in the abolitionist movement. Julie Roy Jeffrey says during the trials, many abolitionists worked together, including blacks and whites.
It sometimes worked very well, and it sometimes didn't work so well, but it was certainly one of the first times that blacks and whites had worked so fruitfully together.
After the Amistad victory, though, the abolitionist movement broke into different groups. Ms. Jeffrey says some black abolitionists wanted more respect from white activists. Other abolitionists just had different ideas about how best to end slavery, by trying to change the country's laws or by appealing to Americans' moral sense of right and wrong. Abolitionism did influence other movements, however. One was the missionary movement. Julie Roy Jeffrey says Christian missionaries had already been going to Africa, hoping to persuade people to follow their religion. But the Amistad case and abolitionism made more people want to share their beliefs with others. Some missionaries even converted the Amistad captives to Christianity and returned to West Africa with them. Ms. Jeffrey says the abolitionist movement also helped create the women's movement in the middle of the 1800s. She says most 19th century white women mainly cared for their families in the home, but women abolitionists played an important public role.
They weighed in on the most political question of the day. They took on activities like collecting petition signatures and raising money and giving speeches.
As a result, Ms. Jeffrey says, some women came to believe they had a right to develop their own beliefs and have political power.
Sometimes they propped up their activism by appealing to things like the Bible. One woman I remember said something like, "I read my Bible and I know what it tells me." And she was opposing the minister in her church, and she was a very active abolitionist.
Yet, even if abolitionism still did not personally affect most Americans, it made an increasing number of people question whether they wanted slavery to continue. Next week, we will tell about the short presidency of William Henry Harrison. And we will continue talking about how slavery influenced presidents and politics over the coming years. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.